Curtis Lewa.
Two young people decided to form their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets. When you see them, you get a nice, secure feeling in your heart.
I admire Curtis Lewa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Lewa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Lewa from WAPC Radio.
Curtis Lewa, legendary New York.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Lewa. What happened today? Why? And what's next? Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Whoop, that is Hitman.
Seven minutes after the hour of five, as we're high atop Madison Square Garden, the great facilities provided to us for this broadcast, as we're ready to hunker down from the gray clouds and the winds that are whipping up, and obviously the rain that is soon to follow. But NJDiet.com has done a marvelous job of insulating us here and putting us in a hermetically sealed all-weather studio so that we can blast out with the 50,000 powerful watts of sound to all of you. As you make that transition, you get back into your pickup trucks, your cars. You're listening to me now on terrestrial radio. Or maybe it's through an app, or maybe it's on the streaming audio, or maybe it's from your worktop computer. And it's our job to try to connect you with everything that's been going on. Well, earlier this morning, in a pre-taped interview, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, was talking about the flap that existed, if you remember, when he went on in one of his Twitter rampages, of which there have been many of late. But that specific one had to do with warning James Comey that he better hope that none of these conversations between he and the president were recorded. And many people implied that that was some kind of a threat. It then led to massive discussions by people who were taken out of their crypt. Some people I hadn't seen in a month of Sundays that I thought were dead from the Watergate era. And all of a sudden, they were making comparisons to Donald Trump and Richard Nixon. Now, I never thought that he had taped those conversations. I always thought it was a bluff. And then finally, because he was subpoenaed by the House Intelligence Committee to deliver any and all recordings or tapes, he decided to indicate, first in a tweet and then on the Fox News channel, exactly why he never taped in any way, shape, or form any of his conversations with Comey.
Well, I didn't tape him. You never know what's happening when you see that the Obama administration, and perhaps longer than that, was doing all of this unmasking and surveillance, and you read all about it, and I've been reading about it for the last couple of months about the seriousness of the and horrible situation with surveillance all over the place, and you've been hearing the word unmasking, a word you probably never heard before. So you never know what's out there. But I didn't tape, and I don't have any tape, and I didn't tape. But when he found out that that there may be tapes out there, whether it's governmental tapes or anything else, and who knows, I think his story may have changed. I mean, you'll have to take a look at that, because then he has to tell what actually took place at the events.
Wow, that's quite a flip. The president oftentimes has made his very own problems. This was a clear example by his tweet that went out, claiming that Comey better hope that no tapes were made of his conversations with Comey. And he's made it worse. Puts himself right in the quicksand and now all of a sudden wants to blame the biggest mistake of his presidency on the former president, Barack Obama. No. This one doesn't stick. But he went on to say on Fox and Friends that the whole investigation that came about as a result of the tweet, because remember what Comey had said, that's what spurred him to immediately decide that memo he had taken of his White House meeting with President Trump should be leaked to the press. And he reached out to his friend, the Columbia University professor, who I think is still in hiding. You know, he's still quivering out there, and decided to use him as the vehicle to release it to the press. As a result of that bombshell report, then all of a sudden, the deputy attorney general decided it was time to bring in a special prosecutor, and that turned out to be the former FBI director Mueller. In fact, let's go to the audio tape of what Donald Trump said on Fox and Friends this morning.
He's very, very good friends with Comey, which is very bothersome. But he's also, and we're going to have to see. I mean, we're going to have to see in terms, look, there has been no obstruction. There has been no collusion. There has been leaking by Comey. But there's been no collusion, no obstruction, and virtually everybody agrees to that. So we'll have to see. I can say that the people that have been hired are all Hillary Clinton supporters.
Oh, please, please. Jeffrey Lord, CNN political commentator. Oftentimes it's you against every Clintonista in the world as you defend the president. But can you defend the president this time when that Twitter rampage of his against Comey actually triggered eventually the appointment of a special prosecutor, Mueller?
Yeah, I mean, why should that have triggered it? I mean, that's the thing that bothers me here. What's going on here, Curtis? The swamp, if you will, has many different tentacles. It's a creature, you know, from the lagoon, as it were. It's got your bureaucrats, it's got your deep state, it's got journalists, it's got lobbyists, consultants, etc. This is the legal division of the swamp, and they're pals. Comey, in this case, Comey and Mueller, and it is very disturbing to think that the FBI director, now fired, wakes up in the middle of the night and decides to give a government document to a buddy who's a law professor. I mean, this shows how this game works. What else has he leaked while he was there? It is very disturbing, and I think this is the real story. And I noticed today that Senator Feinstein and Senator Grassley from the Judiciary Committee, Republican and Democrat, and a couple others on there, both parties, want an investigation into this business that we finally heard from Comey, thankfully, and maybe in part in response to this, that Loretta Lynch's attorney general had instructed him to call the Hillary Clinton's investigation not an investigation, but a quote-unquote matter. In other words, this was political with the lawyers from start to finish. That's what's really troublesome here, and I really do think they need to get into this.
All right. Well, the president on Fox and Friends said that because of the friendship between Comey and Mueller, he's somewhat suspicious of that relationship. But you don't ever think that that would lead to the president actually terminating, firing Mueller?
I don't think so. I'm not sure that it would be a good thing to do. I think Mueller ought to just recuse himself and get out. Frankly, I mean, there's no there with this, Curtis, and this is what has always disturbed me about special prosecutors in general, is if the idea is to investigate an allegation that Curtis eats Jell-O, and then we go from that to, well, Curtis likes to hang out in Palm Beach, and then it becomes Curtis was seen in Nicaragua. I mean, it becomes a whole string of things that had nothing to do with the investigation, the original investigation into Curtis Eats Jell-O. That's where we are here. This is mission creep, if you will. And this is what happened to Bill Clinton. You know, if you remember, it was the Whitewater deal, and then we wound up with Monica. I just think when you give these lawyers money and their prosecutors, they make it their mission in life to find somebody to prosecute. So there's some poor soul out there, and it's probably not the president, who's going to get slammed here. And, I mean, this is just wrong.
Well, let me assure you, Jeffrey Lord, let me go on record that I am no friend of Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. And although I've been to Guatemala,
I picked it at random,
and I've been in Honduras, I have not been to Nicaragua yet.
That's good.
How dare you defame me?
I know. It must have been the beret.
But you're right. These special prosecutors, all of a sudden, what was to be a target of investigation goes in many, many different directions. But what can you do when it was the Deputy Attorney General, Rosenstein, who actually appointed Mueller?
Right. And therein lies the problem. Therein lies the problem. And I just think, you know, this is just not a good situation. And to be perfectly candid, if it weren't Donald Trump and it were some other president and there would be some other set of things going on, you'd find yourself in the same situation. You know, one of the people I've gotten to know on occasion just a bit while I've been at CNN is Alan Dershowitz, the Harvard Law professor emeritus, who's one smart guy. And Alan Dershowitz, I assure you, is no Donald Trump fan. But he thinks this is just horrendous for all kinds of legal reasons. You know, you can't have obstruction of justice charges if there's no underlying crime, for one thing. And there is no underlying crime. I mean, Donald Trump did not collude with the Russians to win the election. I mean, that's just ridiculous on its face. They have found zero evidence of this. And yet here they are now moving from that, which was the original idea, to obstruction of justice, and now also Jared Kushner's finances. And see, that's exactly where we go here. They just branch off onto their thing, and they just keep going until they think they've got somebody for a process crime, you know, that as Karl Rove says, you forget that on, you know, January 5th, you were, you know, an hour late for a meeting because you saw somebody, and you forget this, and boom, you know, you lied to the FBI. I mean, this is just wrong.
Well, I will assure you, I will never forget that you, Jeffrey Lord, are right in the political fault line from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where folks thought it was Pennsylvania that would go for Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. You told all of us, I lived it. That's not the case. You were right. Everybody else was wrong. And I guess we're going to have to go with what Jeffrey Lord said today, because other than that, this investigation is expanding el rápido.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
Those who practice like you.
Deep into the headlines. Deep into the streets.
This is good.
Deep into your eyeballs.
How disgusting.
Studio View is live right now. WABCRadio.com.
You know I feel a lot of people walking around with tombstones in their eyes.
26. Here on the drive home at 5, and it seems like it's been a troika, a trifecta, a trinity of busts of doctors who are writing prescriptions out for opioids to addicts to the tune of millions of pain-killing pills. And all three are in their 70s, and all three have ties to Staten Island. Remember, there is Teschler, just the other week, who was busted in the Upper East Side, and he was accused of selling about 14,000 oxycodone prescriptions that amounted to about 2.2 million pills. Then just this morning, we heard that federal authorities had busted Dr. David Taylor at his office at Highland Boulevard in Oceanic Avenue, and he was charged with running a pill mill that pumped millions of painkillers into his community. And then there is the ongoing case against a guy who lives in Staten Island, Dr. Lazar Fagan, has a palazzo out there, but was running pills through a series of Medicaid mills in Brooklyn. On the line to discuss it, Larry McShane, great gumshoe reporter for New York's hometown newspaper, The Daily News. Thanks for joining us again, Larry, on the drive home at 5.
Oh, yeah, always good to talk to you, Curtis. How you been?
I've had better days, right? Because when I look at these three cases, all of them focusing around Staten Island, all of them involving doctors, either 70 or older. This is like mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, you talked about Fagan. You know, he came up in the news today. The feds are trying to get back, for example, a half dozen properties that he bought, you know, with the 3 million pills that he sold. You know, he had property on Staten Island, a six-bedroom, eight-bathroom mansion. He had two condos in Manhattan. He had a condo in Miami. I mean, these guys are making a lot of money.
And I understand he was running Medicaid mills in Brooklyn?
Yeah, they linked him to three different ones. Supposedly, according to the feds, the three medical clinics prescribed 3.7 million oxycodone pills between 2012 and 2017.
Now, Larry, I would think by now, because I know originally it didn't happen, but the technology is such that every script, every prescription, once it's written, once it's brought to a pharmacy where
right,
it can be processed, would be computerized, that there would be sort of like a fault mark that if all of a sudden somebody was issuing prescriptions beyond, let's say, a quota each month, it would send off warning signals to the DEA or warning signals to the state authorities. Do you know if that technology is in place?
It is in some states, not in all states. I'm not sure about New York, but don't forget some of these cases go back 5 and 6 years, so I'm sure that's before the technology and really before the kind of problem that we're seeing now. I mean, you know, 33,000 Americans dead in 2015 from opioids. There's some estimates that, you know, last year's number could be up close to 60,000.
Larry, why is it taking so many years for law enforcement to do the buy and bust and then to eventually make the arrests and prosecute?
Well, you know, I think part of it was people were not really aware of the problem until now. You know, I'm just actually finishing up a story that's going to run in Sunday's paper about the millions that was spent on lobbying efforts by pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, to try and play down the dangers of these pills, you know. But now in places like Staten Island, I mean, outside of the South Bronx, Staten Island is the number one place in the city for opioid overdoses.
And is that the reason that these three major cases we've seen of late, each of them has been reported in the Daily News, are focused on doctors who either live on Staten Island or practice on Staten Island?
Yeah, I don't know if maybe it's a coincidence. I mean, Fagan, like you mentioned, you know, he operated out of Brooklyn. It's also odd, and you mentioned this, that all three guys are in their 70s, you know?
Now, I must applaud the New York Daily News, and in fact, ladies and gentlemen, if you can't get a hard copy, you got to go online. They have, like, a great four-page spread today in which they let you know everything about opioids, everything about opiates, what the alternatives are, whether it's holistic or homeopathic or just straight-up painkillers that are not going to give you an addiction. This is really a great public service because I think if you go up to an average person in the street, as much as they're aware that people are dropping like flies from opioid abuse and opiate abuse, they have no idea what the opioids are or the opiates.
Yeah, and I think part of the deal with that was to try and give parents a little bit of insight. Like, you know what I mean? If your kid is acting this way or if there are certain behaviors or they use certain expressions, that might be an indication for the red light to go on for parents.
Well, I must tell you, it's a great job in the New York Daily News, but we need to follow the number of oxycodone pills, the hillbilly heroin out there, because when you see the pharmaceutical script that is written, millions of pills by these old aldacockers. I mean, they were in their 70s. Doctors years ago may have been retired at that age. Could it be that they remain in practice simply because the street trade is so lucrative that they can write a prescription as the junkie gives them cash for the prescription? They just keep banking the money, investing it in properties the way narco-terrorists do it, Shorty Pablo Guzman, the way obviously organized crime guys have done over the years, and keep banking the money at the expense of them feeding the belly of the beast. Oh, you got to go online. If for nothing more, to educate your children, your grandchildren, and your neighbors and friends about all the things you need to know about opioids and opiates in today's New York Daily News.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa.
There's nobody that knows this scene better than Curtis Sliwa.
WABCRadio.com.
It's a ritual every night for so many families, not only in our tri-state area, but around the country, to gather around the boob tube and watch Jeopardy with Alex Trebek as the host. On the line to discuss it, especially how it affected his own home area of Bergen County, is Bill Ervolino, columnist at The Record. Thanks for joining us again on the Drive Home at 5, Bill.
Thank you, Curtis. I'd like potent potables for $200, please.
Excellent, but right now I'm sitting shiva. Do you know who I'm sitting shiva for here, Bill Ervolino?
No, share.
Let me announce to all of those trivia buffs out there who follow Jeopardy on a regular basis. Her name, Miriam Brown. She was an advocate for children with autism, a cosmetic patent holder. She spoke five languages, and she was a four-time Jeopardy champion.
Who
just passed away in her Sayville home out in Long Island at the age of 86. We all need to sit shiver over the next 8 days, Bill.
Will do. I got another piece of trivia for you. Alex Trebek and I were both born on July 22nd. How do you like that?
Well, anyway, apparently one of the questions that Alex Trebek came up with had to do with your beloved Bergen County. And let's go to the videotape.
Bergen County, New Jersey has one of the USA's last blue laws, banning retailers from doing this. Chris.
What is selling alcohol?
No. Melissa.
What is selling alcohol on Sundays?
We'll accept that, selling anything on a Sunday.
Okay.
Go again.
Now, Bill Orvelino, did he commit a faux pas? Was he guilty of a fugazi there?
Yeah, this was kind of everybody that lived in Bergen County was like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, you can buy alcohol on Sundays in I think, all of Bergen County. Maybe there's maybe one or two communities where you can't. But for most of Bergen County, after 12 noon. And selling anything on Sundays is also not right because you can buy groceries and you can buy certain things like diapers and you can't get your bustier if you need an emergency girdle or something. You can't run out and get that. And I understand, I've never had this happen to me, but people that go to, say, one of these drugstore type places that sell little everything, they'll take out like the nail polish and the whatever and leave in whatever you can. So they know what you can and can't do. It was just a ridiculous question. Well, in this case, in Jeopardy, it's an answer, not a question. But you know what I mean? The question that they asked was just, there was no answer to it, really. It would have taken half an hour to answer that question.
Well, as you know, in your newspaper, if they're wrong the day before, they issue a correction the next day. Was a correction issued at any point by Alex Trebek, host of Jeopardy, on that question?
I spoke to them. First I sent them an email on Wednesday, then I called. I spoke to them, they were very nice, and they said they have to review it, and as far as I know, they still haven't gotten back to me. I emailed them again. Apparently they have to go through this with whoever is their blue law experts or, you know, discuss it with the Smurfs. I don't know who does it. I don't know who does it, but we've always been very confused about it in the county. One thing I will tell you is that whenever it comes up for a referendum or whatever, people tend to want to keep the laws in place, even though it sounds like it's, you know, which it is like from the 1700s.
Now, Bill Orvelino, have you ever had a secret urge as you were riding around on a Sunday, passing the Paramus Park Mall or the Westfield Garden State Plaza, even if their anchor stores hadn't been vacated, if they're not being boarded up as so many malls are around the country, didn't you ever have the desire to be able to walk into one of those Bergen County malls on a Sunday?
No. Actually, if it was up to me, they would only be open for 7 minutes on a Thursday, and that would be the end of it. The traffic around there, Paramus is a really nice place. It's a great place to eat and everything. And the stores, if you like shopping, which I don't happen to like, it's terrific. But when a trip that will take me 10 minutes on a Sunday will take me 40 minutes during the week because of all the traffic and all the congestion that goes on over there. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most shopping in one area. In the most, the smallest area, the most stores, and concentrated area, that's what I was trying to say.
So you, as a Bergen County resident, you wear this as a badge of courage, as a badge of pride.
You know, let me just, this goes back to me, little boy in Rosedale, Sunday morning, my brother and I would go to church. You know, it was like two blocks away, we'd come back, there'd be two meatballs waiting on the counter for us. We never went shopping. It didn't even occur to us that we were going to go do anything. And but apparently in New York, which I said, like I said, is where I grew up, was in the mid-70s, everybody was getting kind of tired of this. And part of it, I think, is that more women were working. There was less time for the family to do this and that. And everybody was like, we need Sunday, and the stores are closed. And I think they feel it especially around the holidays when they want to get in there a little more, get a little more done. But I personally, it doesn't bother me in the least. like I said, you know, 7 minutes on Thursday, that's enough that I get all my shopping done on that day.
Well, Bill Ervolino of The Record, would you be kind enough to let us know when Alex Trebek gets around to it and issues to you a personal apology that you can convey to all the Bergen County residents?
Maybe he'll tell it on our birthday. He'll tell me. I don't know, but I'm waiting. If we do get if we do get that message, I will certainly let you know.
Ed, you'll be waiting a month of Sundays.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that your email ended up in the round filing cabinet, that abyss that all emails end up going into.
I don't know. Whatever. I'm still waiting. I got my fingers crossed. We'll see what happens. And
yeah.
In the meantime, I'm going to have a nice Sunday. You do the same. Don't go shopping.
Yeah, and have some meatballs, right?
Have some meatballs. I'll have a meatball waiting for you, right?
You got it. That's Bill Ervolino. You need to check, really, all of his columns. You go online at The Record. And I guarantee you, each and every one of them will give you a belly laugh, and you won't stop laughing.
Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
Between the Scylla and Charybdis of commentary.
The Drive at 5, 77 WABC.
I 52. As I continue to take you home on the drive home at 5, I know this inclement weather are coming upon us out there. So hunker down. And just listen to one of my favorite bits, which is about the geriatric espresso-sipping psychotic killers of organized crime. And this one is going to make Vinny the Chin Gigante, who had led the Genovese crime family along with his associate, his underboss, Benny Eggs Mangano, for years. Both of them are going to be turning in their graves when they hear this one. Because their cohorts, the Genovese crime family in Queens, were plotting to rub out a guy named Joseph Bonelli. They had beef with Joseph Bonelli. And this took place in Whitestone, Queens, a heavily developed Italian-American community. So all of a sudden, Louis Sinoco Romano. Now remember, the name Sinoco is important because Louis Sinoco Romano owns a Sinoco gas station in Whitestone, Queens. And he wants Joseph Bonelli dead. And he is a made member of the Genovese crime family. But Louis knows he can't do it himself because Joseph Bonelli knows who he is. So he goes to the capo there in Whitestone, Queens, and he says, look, I need to put together a hit team. I'm going to pay $20,000 of my Sinoco dollars. And that lights him up. And all of a sudden, in the hit team is Salvador Fat Sal Delegati, Robert Old Man DeBello, Ryan Baldy Ellis, and naturally, Louis Sinoco Romano. So it's June of 2014. And the hit team makes the first run at Joseph Bonelli, right outside of his house in Whitestone. But he's got his own gunmen to protect him. And these Italian-Americans are looking at the other Italian-Americans, the Italian stallions, and they identify one another, even though they're mad-dogging one another and eye fornicating, and there are just too many witnesses outside the house. So Louis Sinoco Romano says, let's abort the mission. But I really want this guy, Joseph Bonelli. And I'm willing to ratchet up to pay $50,000 over his head because I want this guy dead. I want him room temperature. I want him 6 feet under in a pine box pushing daisies. So the one guy, Salvador Fat Sal Delegati, says, hey, you know, I remember years ago when they clipped Joe Colombo at the Italian-American Civil Rights Day rally. That's right, of the Italian-American Civil Rights League. There he was in front of 100,000 people at 59th Street Columbus Circle. And Joey Gallo had the contract to put the hit on Joe Colombo, deciding on this strategy. He had befriended a black inmate when he did time in Attica. And somehow he bamboozled the black guy into pretending to be an AP photographer who was there to film the event. And the black photographer got close to Joe Colombo when he was speaking. He pulls out a Thule. He shoots at him 5 times. Joe Colombo's gunmen of the Colombo crime family pull their guns out. They shoot him 50 times. He's dead on arrival. But Joe Colombo was brought over to Roosevelt Hospital, where he remained in a vegetized state for 7 years before he kicked the bucket. So now all of a sudden, Salvatore Fat Sal Delegati is saying, we got to get us some black guys. So he calls up the Crips up in the Bronx, and he talks to Kelvin Duke, who's the brother of Bertram Birdie Duke. and they run the Crips in the Bronx. So Bertram makes a deal for $50,000, and he says, we'll do the hit. We'll go outside of the house of Joseph Benelli and Whitestone. So here comes Bertram Bertie Duke. He puts together the hit team. It consists of Crips, his own brother, Kelvin Duke, who he entrusts as being the head of the hit team, Tyrone Ty McCollum, and Sharif Quarterback Brown. And so now they're stalking Benelli outside of his house, and Benelli comes out. But unbeknownst to them, there's a Nassau County undercover team that's there to arrest Joseph Benelli on other charges. They see the black guys there getting out of their car. They're walking over. They're going to shoot Joseph Benelli. They pull out their guns, and they arrest Kelvin Duke. And what does Kelvin Duke do? The head of this Crip hit team employed by the Genovese to take out Joseph Benelli. He routs out his brother, Bertram Bertie Duke. So they take Bertram Bertie Duke into custody in the Bronx. Then they sweat him down at the local precinct. Then he gives up Salvatore Fat Sal Delagiotti, Robert Old Man DeBello, Ryan Baldy Ellis, and the guy who started it all, who had this blood feud, this vendetta against Joseph Benelli, Louis Sunoco Romano, who owned the Sunoco gas station. Now, what's the moral of this story? What's the lesson of this story? When you're weak, like the Genovese crime family is now, like the Gambinos are, like the Lucchese's, the Colombos, the Bananos, and even the DeCavalcantes, when you look across the Hudson River in New Jersey, you don't co-mingle. The same way if the Crips are weak, or the Bloods are weak, or the Latin Kings are weak, or MS-13 is weak, they don't co-mingle a hit. Have things gotten so desperate now that professional hit squads of organized crime or the street gangs are now commingling and trying to utilize their various resources to put a whack on a person that has a bounty over his head of $50,000? That's why I said, wherever their gravesites are, Vinny the Chin Gigante and Benny Eggs Mangano must be turning in their graves, that the remnants of the Genovese crime family reverted to giving a contract to the Crips street gang, who then ended up ratting out the Genovese, and now they're all going to do time.